trying to get up an ugly row with him. Billy forbore with him and reasoned with him in a pleasant way, and he is something like myself, left-handed, to whom aught like a quarrel is hateful. But nothing served. So, in the second dog watch day, the Red Whiskers, in presence of the others, under pretense of showing Billy just whence a sirloin steak was cut, for the fella had once been a butcher, insultingly gave him a dig under the ribs. Quick as lightning, Billy let fly his arm. I dare say he never meant to do quite as much as he did, but anyhow, he gave the burly fool a terrible drubbing. It took about half a minute, I should think, and the Lord bless you, the lubber was astonished at the celerity. And will you believe it, Lieutenant, the Red Whiskers now really loves Billy. Loves him, or is the biggest hypocrite that ever I heard of.
Thanks indeed to Peter Marinka. Jamila, one of the things that people say about the character of Billy, both in the novella and in the opera, is that he's supposed to be almost a Christ-like figure, an angel-like figure. The figure, the expression, the angel of the Lord, is heard in Captain Vere's voice more than once in the novella. And yet one of the things I've always found puzzling is that central to Billy's downfall and his persona, as in that little passage there, is an act of violence. And I wonder how much should we see him as a Christ-like figure, or is he more complex than that?
I think one symbolism certainly could be Captain Vere as God the Father, Billy as God the Son, and Claggett as a kind of Satan or the serpent in the Garden of Eden. That said, I mean, that can be there in the background, but I mean, Billy, which you get a little bit from this extract, but if you read the opening of the book, he's the sort of character I think we've all seen, we all know, this charismatic person, might be at school, it might be anywhere in the workplace, but we definitely know these kind of people who are so charismatic that people just want to be near them, want a little bit of their stardust. They exude this confidence and beauty, and this is obviously what Billy had, and seemed to be completely innocent of it. He didn't manipulate it. He didn't try to use his charms. He just was.
It's very interesting because Melville had been reading Druid mythology before writing that. And actually, Billy is the Celtic god of the sun, and Bud is the Celtic god of victorious death. So he's definitely investing Billy with this symbolic sensibility.
I mean, have we been going down the wrong path in terms of, you know, decades of description of this as a Christian allegory, Philip? Because Melville himself was extremely ambivalent about Christianity through his life, wasn't he?
Yeah, because, I mean, he had a strong Unitarian influence on him, but also very Calvinistic influence by virtue of his two parents. So if you look back to Moby Dick, indeed, the sense of evil in Moby Dick, which is invested in the animal, Melville's saying this is impossible. Animals aren't evil. Human beings are evil. Ahab is evil. And it's the same with Claggett. Claggett is innately evil in Billy Budd.
Yes, it's this interesting thing of, is there original sin? And Melville obviously seems to think that there is. And his description of Claggett is quite terrifying.
The villain, of course, is Claggett, a symbol of a whole variety of different types of evil. Or, to use a phrase that Plato himself actually came up with, natural depravity. And I wonder if we could hear about the Master at Arms. Peter, would you introduce us to the moral character of the dark-haired and violet-eyed Claggett and that natural depravity?
It folds itself in the mantle of respectability, but these men are madmen, and of the most dangerous sort, for their lunacy is not continuous, but occasional, evoked by some special object. It is protectively secretive, which is as much to say, it is self-contained, so that when, moreover, most active, it is, to the average mind, not distinguishable from sanity, and for the reasons above suggested, that whatever its aims may be, and the aim is never declared, the method and the outward proceedings are always perfectly rational. Now, something such an one was Claggett,
in whom was the mania of an evil nature, not engendered by vicious training or corrupting books or licentious living, but born within him and innate. In short, a depravity according to nature.
Thank you, Peter. Jamila, in that description of Claggart and in the way he's portrayed in the novella, I see shades of Milton's Satan, I see Iago, in other words, the man with the motiveless malignity. There's a lot of literary influence that Melville seems to be bringing to bear on creating this character.
There is, and musically, I hear Don Carlo, the Grand Inquisitor, that sort of crawling, creeping menace whenever Claggart comes along. And I prefer to see that kind of interpretation of Claggart. I don't like seeing him as just a sort of bully on board ship who gets people to do his will by sheer force. There's this wiliness which Melville describes amazingly. I love, you know, the reference of him never actually having any obvious sins. He doesn't drink, he doesn't live licentiously, he has no obvious sins, and yet he is intrinsically evil.
And yet, of course, the central act in the plot is Claggart accusing Billy of something that he hasn't remotely done, an act of ultimate betrayal, you know, ultimate almost motiveless evil.
Well, this is what takes me back to the possibility of seeing it in this symbolic way of the Christian symbolism. And I don't mean Christian as such. I just mean the symbolism of a father, a son, and evil, good against evil. And if you sort of take it to the crucifixion, you've got the betrayal with the coins that he actually, Claggart says to Squeak, I think it is, he'll actually pay him if he can find something on Billy. And Billy is this, he has to be sacrificed, because one of the things at the end, when Vere, in the end, Captain Vere holds Billy's life in his hands, he has it in his gift to save him. He knows he's innocent, it was one act of violence, but he doesn't save him.
But what we are also slightly ignoring is the homoerotic sense of the book. He is not the handsome sailor for nothing. And he, you know, Melville's investment in Billy Budd is heavily sexual. When you read in between the lines, you don't even have to read in between the lines, actually.
Yes.
He's described as resembling Adam in the nude.
Are we projecting back there something, Philip, into the 19th century that does not, you know, that we see in our own era? No, you're saying absolutely not.
But Melville does try.
Hang on, Philip.
If you read the whole of Melville's corpus, it's absolutely clear what's going on. It's absolutely clear. And even in the titles of his books, you know, you go from Redburn, White Jacket, Billy Budd, Moby Dick, they are heavily masculine. Show me a woman in any of Melville's books. There's one woman in Moby Dick. There are no women in Billy Budd. Whole thing... I know it's kind of slightly reductivist to do that, but it's also slightly disingenuous not to do that, and it's actually not respecting Melville as an artist and the subtle way that he portrays that. But think about Moby Dick. Think about Moby Dick, in which there's entire chapters about whale's foreskin. There's an entire chapter devoted to men squeezing their hand in tubs of
sperm. But just thinking with Billy Budd for a moment there, Philip, what is the connection between the homoeroticism...
Sorry to get excited.
No, absolutely. It's an important theme, and... We're going to get plenty of questions, but what is the link there to what Jamila was bringing up, which is the question of the allegories of good and evil, whether or not they're Christian or not?
Yeah.
I mean, surely that's a separate question from the question of sexuality.
Because just interject, is one line. Everything you say is true. Mm. It's all there.
Yeah.
But then Melville says, but this was not the same as Saul and David. If you think that, you are wrong. He literally says that.
Yeah, no, but it is quite clear what Claggart's... why he has been rebuffed by the handsome sailor. That's the complete undertow of what's going on.
I would like to bring a bit more evidence in front of this drumhead court, because I think we're getting somewhere very interesting. And the way I'm going to do that is to bring in the third reading, because with this reading, what we have is a section from the climax of the book where Billy hears his sentence, the sentence of death, and he blesses the man responsible for his punishment, Captain Vere. Clearly one of the passages that, amongst other things, does reinforce the Christ-like parallels. Peter.
Without volition, as it were, as if indeed the ship's populace were but the vehicles of some vocal current electric, with one voice from below and aloft came a resonant, sympathetic echo. God bless Captain Vere! And yet at that instant, Billy alone must have been in their hearts, even as he was in their eyes. At the pronounced words and the spontaneous echo that voluminously rebounded them, Captain Vere, either through stoic self-control or a sort of momentary paralysis induced by emotional shock, stood erectly rigid as a musket in the ship armorer's rack. At the same moment, it chanced that the vapory fleece hanging low in the east was shot through with a soft glory, as of the fleece of the Lamb of God seen in mystical vision, and simultaneously therewith, watched by the wedged mass of upturned faces, Billy ascended, and ascending, took the full rose of the dawn.
I mean, without being reductionist, as you say, Philip, we have the line there about Captain Vere standing erectly rigid, and also here what is quite a common confluence, which is the moment of sudden execution and sexual climax. Yeah. I mean, are we meant to read these connections
there? Because immediately after that, you have an entire section devoted to the fact that the ship surgeon attests the fact that that doesn't happen in Billy's case. That, you know, the sense of, you know, a sexual orgasm at the moment of hanging, of death, that doesn't happen. And it just ties in really more with what you're saying, Jamila, is the sense of this purity, this kind of spotless lamb. It's that gives it that much more power, really.
I mean, I think everything you say is there. You can't get away from that. But I think there are so many other elements. It's just not simple. I mean... After all, Vere is also, a lot of critics will say that Vere too has some kind of suppressed homosexual feelings for Billy. But then you can look at it from the point of view of the father figure. I mean, remembering that Melville was apparently a very cold and distant father, and his own son committed suicide, and this is before Billy Budd was written. Is there some sort of guilt? And
I don't think that's true exactly about Melville. I think partly because Melville, look, he's a gay man who's in this marriage which is unhappy. He becomes alcoholic. Another son actually also dies very young as well. The thing that's so exciting about Billy Budd is that all kind of comes to an amazing, intense, poetic, elegiac, melancholy fruition in this extraordinary work, which has this power, because it wasn't published until 1924, it's still exploding on us, like Moby Dick. It's so full of critical power, even now. I think that's what's so exciting about it.
That is all we have time for this evening, but I think we've had a fantastic discussion. Many thanks again to our guests, Jamila Gavin, Philip Hoare, and Peter Marinka.
Rana Mitter presenting a Proms Plus literary event down at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Zahid Worley. Welcome back from me, Martin Handley, to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight at the BBC Proms and live here on Radio 3, home of the Proms, we're on board the HMS Indomitable in the year 1797, listening to the drama on the ship unfold during Britain's opera Billy Budd, being given tonight in semi-staged form by Glyndebourne Opera. The opera was commissioned by the Arts Council for the Festival of Britain in 1951 with E.M. Forster and Eric Crozier using the novella by Herman Melville we've been hearing about during the interval as the basis for their libretto. Young Billy himself represents goodness and beauty, and in a sense he sacrifices himself Christ-like for the rest of the ship. I asked Jacques Imbrio, who sings Billy, how he sees his role.
I think as a personality he is very flawed. He has got the stammer, the pure physical flaw. He's got a bit of a temper, which I think he gets angry with himself when he loses his temper. So I think he's more complicated than just this cardboard figure of goodness. He's very often seen as less intelligent than people around him, and I think it's not that. I think it's he's got a completely different view of the world, and he looks at things differently. He's got this view of wanting to see the best in everybody, to the point of it being a flaw.
Well, Forster and Britton may have modified the characters in Melville's novella, but the core of the story in Act Two remains entirely the same. Claggett brings a false charge of mutiny against Billy. Vere sees them both in his cabin. Asked to defend himself, Billy stammers and, frustrated, aims a blow at Claggett, who falls dead. Vere panics and hastily summons a court-martial, at which he refuses to save Billy, and Billy is hanged. The struggle between good and evil, Billy and Claggett, is something we hear throughout the music, epitomised by two chords, one major, one minor. That ambiguity also represents the moral uncertainty which runs through the opera, particularly as it affects Captain Vere. Like Verdi, Britton is masterly in his juxtaposing of the public scenes of life on board the ship and the personal dramas of Vere, Billy and Claggett, using the colours of the orchestra to articulate the characters and their emotions. The most extraordinary music of all is the sequence of 34 slow chords played as offstage Vere tells Billy of his death sentence. The chords vary hugely in colour and dynamic. Maybe at the end they've wiped away Claggett's evil. Andrew Davis.
What I love about the production is that Michael Grandage actually leaves the stage empty. There's no business going on, and we just know that what's happening is Vere is telling of the decision to Bud, which, of course, is heart-rending and painful for him, and, as we know in the epilogue, is something that he never has got over. And although he says, "I've sighted a sail in the storm," and, you know, it's like he echoes Bud saying, "I'm contented," just before he's hanged. We don't believe either of them, actually.
Act two of the opera begins with just that combination of public and private that Britton is so good at. Vere and his officers are ready for battle, but frustrated by the mist surrounding the Indomitable. Claggett uses the time to start to tell Vere about Billy before the mist clears to reveal a French ship and the crew is called to action stations. Andrew Davis back on the platform, joining the LPO here in the Royal Albert Hall to conduct Act Two of Britton's Billy Boat.
The look of the mist, Mr. Redburn. No more do I, sir. It may lift, but not for long. Time we came to action, time indeed. The men are getting impatient with this long waiting. That I well understand. Don't like the look of the mist. Send Mr. Claggett up. The captain will see you. Master at arms.
recompense me, I would be failing in my trust unless I came to you at once.
Speak freely! What is it?
Your honor, I have served my country long and have striven in all ways to serve you here upon the Indomitable.
Master, at arms! Your work is satisfactory. What do you want to say?
But that I need not say it. I could keep silent, but there is danger, sir. There is danger aboard. Danger from one who...
Thank you. wait to fire.
Wait yet, we're out of range.
Report all canvas sets, main top.
Aye, 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 all sail set.
All canvas sets up.
Too little for this breeze, I'm afraid. Are we making, Mr. Redburn?
Belly, sir. Belly,
sir.
Men talk, do you reckon we making?
We
Mr. Redburn, sights below 18s. We'll try a shot. Give orders to dismiss.
Abandon chase, all hands.
Down one watch! Down one watch!
Thank you.
master at arms. Come up if the matter's urgent.
Affected, sir, blind for the crimes of Spithead and the A common seaman, but a subtle schemer, plotting between decks, sapping loyalties, corrupting messmates. Yes, even in this fight, when all hearts should run out of common purpose, fomenting colony the power, mutiny.
Mutiny! Mutiny! I'm not to be scared by words! Your evidence for this?
Perhaps Your Honor would inspect these guineas. He crept and offered them at dead of night to a young novice. You will understand how their bright wonder and pretty twinkling would tempt a simple boy. But he held firm and came at once and handed them to me.
A king, a boy by gold, a common seaman. Strange storm. What's his name?
His name is William Budd.
Budd. Billy Budd, for top man.
The same.
Nay, you're mistaken. Your police have deceived you. Don't come to me with some familiar tale. That's the young fellow I get good reports of. Hey, you're mistaken.
There's
don't come to me with some familiar tale.
The past is deep.
Past and accounts I cannot agree.
No,
I have seen many men in my time. And I trust him.
A man traffics under those bloody today.
I take heed what you say. There's a yardarm for a false witness.
Sir, Your Honor.
Oh, I'll see the fellow at once. Boy!
Yes, sir.
You know William Butt for top man?
Oh, yes. Billy Budd, sir.
Find him. Bring him aft. Bring him aft to my cabin. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
You, master at arms, when you've seen Budd enter, follow him quietly. I have heard you speak. I wish to speak with him. In a few minutes, you will be admitted and confront him.
Thank you, Your Honor. I trust that nothing I have done
is as good as a living. Oh, this hurts! I've studied men and their ways. The mists are vanishing. And you shall fail. John Claggart, beware. I'm not so easily deceived. You wanted to see me. I knew I'd be called Captain of the Mizzen. Oh, the honor, and you telling me I shouldn't speak so quick, but the talk's got around. Would you like to be captain of the Mizzen, Billy Bart? Yes, or to be your coxswain? I'd like that too, to be near you. I'd serve you well, indeed I would. You'd be safe with me. You could trust your boat to me. Couldn't find a better coxswain. That's to say, I'd look after you my best.
And
I'd die for you.
This is the sorry
all. Aren't I glad to be here? Didn't know what life was before now.
Oh, for a fight.
Wish we got that fishy. Wish we got that fishy. I do.
I do not want to see you about promotion.
That's all right, sir. I'm content.
Very well. But now listen to me, Bud. We want to question you, I and the master at arms.
Yes, sir.
Answer us frankly and show all proper respect. Now stand to attention. Boy, admit Mr. Claggart.
Your comrades and
Gentlemen, the court sits. Captain Vere of striking your superior officer, John Claggett, Master at Arms, and thus causing his death. Captain Vere.
The Master at Arms! Denounce the prisoner to me for spreading disaffection, sympathy with our enemies, and trying to start a mutiny.
Oh, no!
Having French gold for bribes. I asked the prisoner to reply. He stammered and struck John Claggett on the forehead. And the rest you know.
Captain Vere has spoken. Is it as he has said?
Yes.
You know the articles of war.
Yes.
And the penalty.
Yes.
Why did you do it?
Loyal to my country and my king. It is true, I'm a nobody who don't know where he was born. And I've had to live rough, but never could I do those foul things. It's a lie. It's a lie.
Against the Master at Arms.
Oh, I tried to answer him back. My tongue wouldn't work. So I had to say it with a blow, and it killed him.
You stammered then.
Aye, it comes and it goes.
Why should the Master at Arms accuse you wrongfully?
I don't know such things. Ask Captain Vere. Ask him.
Do you, sir, know any reason?
I have told you all I have seen. I have no more to say.
Prisoner, have you any more to say?
Captain Vere, save me.
Go in and wait.
Captain, save me.
Go in.
I'd have died for you.
Go in!
Save me!
Your verdict.
Guilty.
And the penalty. Floating monarchy have exact
Thank you. Old friend, that's fine. That's kind. Give me a biscuit too. I feel better. Coming to see me, you'll get into trouble.
All is trouble, the whole ship's trouble, and upside down.
What for?
Some reckon to rescue. Billy boy, how they hated the Jenny legs. They swear you shan't swing.
I'll swing and they'll swing.
They love you.
I'll swing and they'll swing.
They love you.
Tell him that and stop them. Tell him that and stop them. I feel better. Done me a lot of good. A drink. A friend stopped me from thinking on what's no use and dreaming what needn't be dreamt and woken me up to face what must be. What must the day to be?
A fair day.
We'd have caught that Frenchie on a fair day.
curse nicht, that curse nicht. Maybe you'll still catch her. You better be going now. Goodbye, baby. Can't shake hands. Chaplin's been here before you. Kind and goody story of the good boy hung and gone to glory. Hung for the likes of me, the likes of me. But I had strike down the jammy legs, it's fate. Captain Vere has had to strike me down. Fate! We're both in sore trouble, him and me, with great need for strength. And my troubles are mainly, so I can't help him longer with his starry gear. God bless him! The clouds darker than night. Help him, all of you. That's good. Goodbye. Goodbye. And farewell to ye, old rights, O man. Never your joys no more. Farewell to this grand rough world. No more sea. Oh, looking down from the heights to the depths, but I sight a sail in the storm, the far shining sail that's not fate. And I'm done tempted. I've seen where she's bound for. She has a
shall strike any of his superior officers, he shall suffer death. It is further provided that if any of the fleet commits murder, he shall be punished by death. William Bart, you have been found by the court-martial guilty of striking your superior officer. You have further been found guilty of
have saved him. I could have saved him. He knew it. Even his shipmates knew it. The earthly laws silenced them. The love that passes understanding has come to me. I was lost on long ago now, years ago, centuries ago, when I, Edward Fairfax Vere, commanded thee.
Captain Vere recognises he's been saved by the man he failed to save. He claims that now, like Billy, he can be at peace. But those final bars cast a shadow over whether that's really the case. The end of Benjamin Britten's opera, Billy Budd. in a semi-stage performance of Michael Grandage's production for Glyndebourne Festival Opera. Bud himself, sung by Jacqueline Brilo, Captain Veer by Mark Padmore, Brindley Sherritt was John Claggett, Stephen Gadd was Mr. Redburn, David Saw, Mr. Flint, Darren Jeffrey, Lieutenant Radcliffe. Alistair Elliott sang Red Whiskers, John Moore Donald, Jeremy White Danske, Peter Gisbertson the Novice, Colin Judson Squeak and Richard Mosley Evans the Bosun. Main top was Dean Power, Novice's friend Duncan Rock, First Mate Michael Wallace, Second Mate Benjamin Kahn. I'll break off because the Chorus Master Jeremy Bynes has just appeared on the stage for that huge cheer for the Glyndebourne Festival Chorus. First Mate Michael Wallace, Second Mate Benjamin Kahn, Arthur Jones, Brendan Collins, Cabin Boy Charlie Gill, and the Midshipmen Sebastian Davis, Tom Foreman, Quentin Zach Martins, and Will Roberts. The Glyndebourne Festival Chorus and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Peter Schumann, conducted by Andrew Davis, the director for this revival of Michael Grandage's production, Ian Rutherford. And the boys coming onto the front of the stage now. And that immense silence engendered by that incredible end to the piece and also by Mark Padmore's slow walk from the stage off down the Bull Run. Marvellous visuals in the battle scene with the red of the marine drummers and the marines who appeared at the end again with guns when the mutinous sailors murmured after the hanging. A long rope right down from a balcony here in the Albert Hall was pulled tight and tighter still in that mind-blowing, mind-numbing music for the hanging itself. The novice, Peter Gisbertson, takes his applause. I asked Mark Padmore what happened during those chords when there's nobody on stage. When Veer goes to see Billy, he said an understanding must be reached between them, something spiritual passes between them. He also says that Veer's a man who's never known love, and he is, in a sense, in love with Billy, just not able to express it. That roar for Danske. Jeremy White. And the three officers, Stephen Gadd, Mr. Redburn, David Saw, Mr. Flint, Darren Jeffrey, Lieutenant Radcliffe. All bearded. Well, I think you can tell by the roar of applause and appreciation, but the mock boos, who that was. Brindley Sherritt's John Claggett. Evil personified, literally, but the nicest of men, really. Mark Padmore, Captain Veer. Says this is the most wonderful text to sing that Crozier and Forster produced. It's just a joy to do it. And the music written for Peter Pears. Jack Imbrino. By a nice piece of synchronicity, he starts rehearsals for Don Giovanni for Scottish Opera tomorrow morning, directed by Sir Thomas Allen, one of the great Billy Budds himself. All the soloists in a line forward. Back comes Sir Andrew Davis, I have to say, running. Tremendous enthusiasm and joy in this piece. Just how much he loved it. It was evident when I was talking to him earlier. Shakes the hand of Peter Schumann, the leader of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Well, tomorrow at 7:30, the Albert Hall will resound to the music of another 20th century giant, Stravinsky. BBC Symphony Orchestra and Josef Pons frame their programme with him, ending with that miraculous ballet score, Petrushka. In between, Frank-Peter Zimmermann, the soloist in Brahms' Violin Concerto, world premiere of Charlotte Zeiser's Language of Leaving, and all that before Django Bates entered the building at 10:15. But for now, from an Albert Hall first stunned and now hugely uplifted, as you can hear, by Britain's magnificent opera, time for me to place you gently on dry land into the hands of Ian Skelly to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you very much indeed. It's rather sad to leave that atmosphere. That was Martin Handley, a midget at the Royal Albert Hall. There's more Benjamin Britten tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, by the way. A second chance to hear the Saturday matinee prom from this weekend just gone. Britten's variations on an Elizabethan theme. Well, I say his variations. He instigated them. He wrote one of them. The rest came from Lennox Barclay, Arthur Oldham, Humphrey Searle, Michael Tippett and William Walton. A set of variations created in 1953 to mark the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II and using a theme from the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. The original was Sellinger's Round, originally harmonised by William Byrd. That was the version which inspired Britten, and you can hear it tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock as part of our Proms Repeat here on Radio 3. Well now, as for the rest of tonight, as Martin was implying, the lawyer Albie Sachs continues to reflect on his work as the Justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa in just over half an hour's time. That's in Strange Justice, our essay at 11:15. Then Nick Luscombe will be here taking the reins in the studio to bring the first of this week's editions of Late Junction to the air. British electronics feature this week, as well as songs from Mali. And he's going to whisk you back to the 1970s to hear the sounds of the summer in that decade. Corky Carroll, a pro surfer, will entertain you, presumably in flares and a bright orange swimsuit. Late Junction, as ever a surprise, from 11 o'clock tonight here on Radio 3. Well, it's now just after 10 past 10. This is Ian Skelly with the music for the next 35 minutes or so. And music by Schumann next, and from a relatively peaceful time in his life when he was young. A piano piece written as a response to the sonatas of Beethoven. Andras Schiff plays the Fantasia in C. brooding moods stirring the mist, and echoes of Beethoven too in Schumann's Fantasia in C, played by András Schiff. A member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme, the soprano Ruby Hughes, appears at the Proms on the 4th of September. She'll be singing the four last songs by Vaughan Williams. She's in the final year with the New Generation Artist Scheme, and I thought we could hear her next this evening. Not with the large forces of the BBC Symphony Orchestra that she'll be alongside next week, but for rather smaller forces. Earlier this year, at St Paul's Knightsbridge, she was joined by the lutenist Thomas Dunford and playing the viola da gamba Christoph Urbanitz, and they were performing songs by John Dowland. A song by John Dowland, All Ye Whom Love or Fortune Hath Betrayed, sung by Ruby Hughes with the lutenist Thomas Dunford and playing the viola da gamba Christoph Urbanitz. Dowland was a well-travelled composer. He was born, we think, in London. He worked for a time in Paris. He was a student at Oxford and a court musician in Denmark in the service of King Christian IV, who eventually sacked him because he was forever disappearing off back to Blighty. So he returned to his hometown, and with the Protestant Queen Elizabeth I dead, he managed to secure himself a job as lutenist in the service of James I. We'll hear two more songs from his many lute books composed during that time, Can She Excuse My Wrongs, and to begin, In Darkness Let Me Dwell.
Can she excuse my wrongs with virtue's cloak? Shall I call her good when she proves unkind? Are those clear fires which vanish into smoke? Must I praise the leaves when no fruit I find? No, where shadows do for body stand, thou mayst be a muse if thy sight be. Cold love is like to words written on sand. two bowels which on the water swim. Wilt thou be thus accused still, seeing that she will fright thee never? If thou canst not overcome, how will thy love be thus fruitless ever? Wilt thou be thus accused still, seeing that she will fright thee never? If thou canst not overcome, how will thy love be thus fruitless ever? Was I so base that I might not aspire unto those high joys which she holds from me? As they are high, so high is my desire. If she this deny, what can grant it be? If she will yield to that which reason is, it is reason's will that love should be just. Dear, make me happy still by granting this. Oh, that oft in days that I die I must. Better a thousand times to die than for to live thus still tormented. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake would die contented. Better a thousand times to die than for to live thus still tormented. Dear, but remember it was I who for thy sake would die contented.
Can She Excuse My Wrongs? A song by John Dowland, sung by a current member of Radio 3's New Generation Artist Scheme, Ruby Hughes. Thomas Dunford played the lute and Christoph Urbanitz the viola da gamba. Well, next they perform one of John Dowland's most well-known lute songs, Come Again, Sweet Love. It was included in Dowland's first book of songs, or airs, which appeared in 1597, and it's a bittersweet song, the poet clearly in love, but the girl is, well, certainly playing hard to get, perhaps not that keen at all.
Come again, sweet love doth
gentle love, draw forth thy word.
Come Again, Sweet Love by John Dowland, sung by Ruby Hughes. Well, we're going to end this sequence of songs by Dowland, sung by Ruby Hughes, with Thomas Dunford playing the lute and Christoph Urbanitz the viola da gamba, with two more songs, Go Crystal Tears, and to end their collection, I Saw My Lady Weep.
I saw
I saw my lady weep, the final song in this programme of music by John Dowland, recorded earlier this year at St Paul's Knightsbridge by Ruby Hughes, with the lutenist Thomas Dunford, and providing that melancholic ground on the viola da gamba, Christoph Urbanitz. Well, you can hear Ruby Hughes again when she sings some rather more recent songs, the four last songs by Ralph Vaughan Williams, in our prom on the 4th of September. That's a week tomorrow. The BBC Symphony Orchestra will be conducted by Osmo Vanska, and the programme also includes two symphonies, the third by Goretzky, his Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, and to end, the sixth symphony by Tchaikovsky, the Pathétique. That's at 7:30 next Wednesday evening. Well, Nick Luscombe begins a week of all kinds of musical combinations in Lake Junction in 15 minutes' time, after the next of our essays this week. They're given by a former member of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, Judge Albie Sachs, who continues his examination of the challenges he and the court faced in post-apartheid South Africa.
I was lying in a hospital bed, my right arm blasted off, my left eye blind, but feeling triumphant at the London hospital, recovering from the bomb that had nearly taken my life some weeks before in Maputo, where I'd been living in exile as a law professor. And most of the time I felt joyous. That moment had come that every freedom fighter is waiting for. Will they come for me? They came for me, and I survived. I got through. But at about 4 in the morning, and the light is just beginning to seep into the hospital, and the painkillers have worn off, and I'm feeling very alone, and I would sing to myself, it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's not my brother nor my sister, and I'd go through my whole family and feel very, very isolated until I'd sleep a bit more, the nurses would come in, I would cheer up again and feel bright. This was long before, years before I even dreamt of becoming a judge. The years pass, I am a judge. And one of the early cases that came to us brought into play this very idea. How do we deal with the atrocities of the past, the people who'd done unspeakable things? Do we do to them what they'd done to us? Or is there another way of looking at the matter? And this came through in terms of the Azapo case, the Zanian People's Organization, a very active body of mainly African intellectuals and other people from the indigenous African community, who said, this is going too far. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been set up. We're not against that in itself. But you are depriving us of the chance of suing the people who had tortured our relatives to death, who had maimed us, who had done awful things to us. And that's depriving us of the right to a fair trial to settle our disputes as the Constitution provides. The response to that was the Constitution itself made provision for the setting up of a truth commission in a very beautifully crafted epilogue and spoke about dealing with the tragedies and atrocities of the past, not in a spirit of vengeance, but in a spirit of reconciliation. Not retaliation, but Ubuntu. Ubuntu, a deep African philosophical concept, very prominent in South African society to this day, of human interdependence. I am a person because you're a person. I can't separate my humanity from your humanity. We are all responsible for each other. The court was unanimous. A provision in the Truth and Reconciliation Act, which said that the people who'd been victimized by the practices of the state in the past, or who had suffered as a result of actions of the freedom fighters, liberation struggles, people themselves unjustly, would be entitled to forms of compensation. But there would be no access to the courts to sue the perpetrators for what they had done. And the court accepted that. It was a way of getting to the truth, of discovering the bodies of people who'd been disappeared, killed, assassinated, of the families being able to learn about how those who they'd loved so much had been fighting for freedom, what their lost hours would be. And it would be a move towards, as it was put, a bridge towards a new, more whole, integrated, reconciled South Africa as opposed to the divisions of the past. The judgment for the court was written by Deputy President of the Court, Ismail Mohammed. I was so inspired when I saw the draft, I rushed out of my chambers, down the corridors, I knocked on Ismail's door, I burst in, I said, Ismail, this is a brilliant, beautiful, poetic piece of writing. He looked quite startled. Judges normally don't praise each other like that, but my emotion was so strong that I had to do it. And to this day, the Azapo judgment stands up, it reads beautifully, it's powerful, it's contested. But now our court was taking a stand in terms of how do you deal with people whose conduct has been atrocious? Are they entitled to the protections of the very society they wanted to prevent coming into being, in the case of Democratic South Africa, or as in the next case we had to deal with, Mr. Mohammed, a Tanzanian who had allegedly participated in the blowing up of the American embassy, killing 50, 60 people, most of them Tanzanians as it happened, mass murder. Are people like that, who are denying the very character of the legal system that we're operating under, entitled to protection under that system? And we decided in the case of Mr. Mohammed, yes. He'd come to South Africa under a false name, was working very quietly as a pastry cook, apparently a very good pastry cook. The FBI knew he was in South Africa. They had his picture. They didn't know his name. They were waiting for him at immigration, pounced when he turned up, and within 36 hours, he was on a plane to New York to stand trial for mass murder. His employer wanted to know what's going on here, went to court, was fobbed off, was denied the chance of providing legal representation, and now was asking the court to do something. When the matter went to the High Court said, Mr. Mohammed is here illegally, he can be deported, there's nothing we can do, end of matter. The Constitutional Court was not satisfied. And I must say, I found this very, very moving. 11 of us with completely different life experiences and backgrounds. My colleague, Laurie Ackerman, used to collect wine labels. A deeply committed Christian, extremely important, the Kantian philosophy that he had in his reasoning. I, from a secular background, internationalist struggle, other people, each one with their own life story and history. But through the Constitution, the prism of the Constitution, we could agree on certain core values. And one of them was everybody is entitled to legal defense. If anything, the more horrendous your crime, the more important it is that you should have legal defense to see what can possibly be said and done in mitigation or explanation or whatever it might be. And more profoundly in this case, the fact that he had been rendered, there was rendition it was called, without getting an agreement from the United States government that if found guilty he would not be executed, meant that the South African authorities who'd handed him over had violated our constitution because we prohibited capital punishment. And we made very strong comments about that and sent our decision to the judge handling the matter in New York. I believe he acquainted the jury of our position, and by a majority of 7-5, they said no capital punishment. And I might say that in the case of one of his co-conspirators from Germany, that assurance had been given. It was as if somehow South Africa, African continent, you know, we don't have to bother about these rule of law aspects and international aspects. Just slip him across the country and get him, ensure that he gets his just deserts in a New York court. And we were now saying, no, your vision of our country is completely wrong. We are a constitutional democracy. And however abominable the alleged crime might have been, the person is entitled to certain core fundamental values enshrined in our constitution. The next case was that of so-called Dr. Death, Dr. Wouter Besson, who had been in charge of the bacteriological and chemical warfare programs of the South African military in the last years of apartheid, very, very active in particular in Namibia, where the South African military were fighting, combating the Namibian forces under SWAPO, Southwest Africa, a people's organization fighting for their independence. The charges were that he had used asphyxiating drugs to paralyze captives who'd then been taken in small planes over the sea and their bodies dropped for them to be eaten by the sharks. Horrendous, terrible. But at his trial, the witnesses, according to the judge who heard the matter, didn't give evidence of sufficient cogency to permit a conviction. Another aspect of his trial was that he was charged with using money from the military to enrich himself of fraud, that he'd bought, I don't know if it was a golf course, but a pleasure resort, hotels, things like that, registered in his own name. His answer was, yes, he had bought those properties, but he'd done so in the name of agents in East Germany and in Russia who'd been working with him and who wanted a reward, an offshore reward that was in South Africa. The judge said he believed him, or his story could reasonably be true. The matter was taken on appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the main issue there was that the trial judge had quashed, had suppressed charges against Dr. Besson on the basis that you couldn't prosecute somebody in South Africa for an offence they'd committed in another country, in Namibia. And that was appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeal, who were very indignant about the sloppy documents that had been presented to it and threw out the appeal. That, in turn, was appealed to us, and we said no. When you're dealing with war crimes, crimes against humanity, you can't allow the fact that the State Council had not prepared their documents properly to prevent a prosecution. And in terms of the merits of the case, if the conspiracy in South Africa had been used to use the South African army in Namibia, and given that these war crimes create international universal jurisdiction, the case should have gone on. The matter went back to the prosecution. They decided in the end there wasn't enough evidence at that stage to get a prosecution, and the criminal charges weren't proceeded with. There was a moment during the hearing in our court where I reacted quite strongly. I just saw Dr. Besson walking up and down, smirking, chatting to his counsel. Somehow this was inappropriate. These were such grave issues. Some kind of decorum was required. And when it came to my turn to put questions to his counsel, I said, Dr. Besson is a liar. We know that he's a liar because he himself has told us that he's a liar, that when he registered these properties in his name, he was doing so falsely. There was dead silence. People do wicked things. It doesn't mean we must take our standards from their vision of the world. And the function of courts in times of greater stress and crisis is precisely to maintain and entrench the very values that are under threat from people who want to overthrow the democratic order and principles of human rights.
That was Albie Sachs, and he continues his essay series on Thursday evening, reflecting on the issues of equality in the new South Africa. Strange Justice was first broadcast on Radio 3 in June last year. The time now is 11 o'clock.